Peter Balakian artfully weaves history, trauma, and personal stories throughout his poetry, most recently in his 2016 Pulitzer Prize winner, Ozone Journal. Today he explores our culture and the reverberations from 9/11 with his earlier book, Ziggurat. Referring to ancient Middle Eastern temple towers, the book is a contemplation on architecture, visual arts, and Balakian's own experiences at the World Trade Center.
I'm not writing my autobiography in verse. The real life was lost a long time ago. But one draws on one's locations as a person in the world. It's a complicated weave between the invented realities and the dimensions of experience that have rooting in one's own life. But it's the weave that gives poetry its energy.
Poet, translator, and nonfiction writer Peter Balakian in 2010. Hear him read from Ziggurat as he talks with Rebecca Preston Mosby, a former New Letters on the Air host and part of our classics series from UMKC's New Letters magazine. I'm Angela Elam. Born in New Jersey, Peter Balakian is no stranger to writing about trauma. As the grandson of a survivor of the Armenian genocide that took place in Turkey from 1915 to 1918, Balakian's nonfiction books include The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response, and his memoir, Black Dog of Fate, which won the 1998 Penn Albrand Prize and was featured on the TV program 60 Minutes. But it's his sixth collection of poetry, the 2010 book Ziggurat, that we'll explore today with our special guest host.
I'm Rebecca Preston Mosby, sitting in today for Angela Elam. We're recording in Hamilton, New York, at Colgate University, where our guest, Peter Balakian, is the Donald M. and Constance H. Rebar Professor in Humanities. In this book, you have many, many themes, the major one of which is a comparison between the great temples, the ziggurats of the ancient world, particularly the Sumerian ziggurat at Ur, and the great ziggurat or American temple, the World Trade Center towers. You start right off by introducing us to the World Trade Center, and I think what makes this weave, as it were, work so seamlessly in Ziggurat is that you have spent the last 10 years, or maybe more than that, I don't know, intensively researching Middle Eastern and Far Eastern, Near Eastern history.
Well, I think the big exploration for me in the piece of the long poem, A Train Ziggurat Elegy, that located the poem in the excavation of the ziggurat at Ur was the autobiographical memoir account by the archaeologist and excavator himself, Leonard Woolley. I mean, it was really the primary book of my knowledge, was reading Woolley's own experience in the late 1920s and early 1930s, in which he was excavating this magnificent lost, what we might call the first great skyscraper in Western civilization, the ziggurat at Ur. I wanted for my book to become a trope for great building, great tower, skyscraper, and that it would then echo with its strange reverberations to have meaning for the World Trade Towers, which were certainly among the great ziggurats of the modern world.
That's a lovely image. Yeah, it's a great metaphor. Now, the poem that you were referring to, the Woolley poem, is the long poem in the center of the book. It's a three-part book, and that's in part two. But why don't we just go ahead and read a little bit from your A Train Ziggurat Elegy poem. Part 5 and part 25 really talks about Woolley extensively.
Yeah, the persona. He's traveling on the subway, the A train, down from north to south underneath Manhattan, and he's reading about excavating the great skyscraper.
He meaning the narrator.
The narrator is reading Leonard Woolley's book about excavating the ziggurat at Ur, circa 1930, and then the narrator flashes back to a time when he was a mail runner for a steamship company in Lower Manhattan.
And this is a job you did actually have, right?
Yes, it's a job I did have. And I did watch the World Trade Towers be built week by week. And I did spend a lot of time running mail up and down the World Trade Towers from the time they opened into the first years of the 1970s. And the towers have become, for me and my exploration of them in retrospect, also zones of imaginative exploration of ideas and aesthetics, as well as place, the place that they were. Because I think they were stunning architectural monuments, really. And Yamasaki, I think, created one of the last great monuments of modernism in the austere minimalism of the design of those buildings. I'll start with section 5. But to Woolley, it wasn't Iraq. It wasn't post-empire or Faisal's kingdom. It was precise and chaotic, digging into the beginning, as if the piece of the snake's tail that was swallowed by the mouth made the full circle of history. Quote, all the bodies lay on their backs, rigidly extended, hands crossed below the stomach, the graves dug into the silt were. After the flood, decayed brick, ashes, potsherds, flints, clay figurines. I used to think of post-diluvian as theoretical, but if you ask, what became of the Sumerians? Quote, it grieves me to watch the end of any good work to which men have given so much thought and skill. End quote. Woolley might have agreed with Duchamp, who thought America's greatest art was its plumbing, and NYC the summation of sewage pipes and sinks, which join here in the 59th Street station, where we're stuck, and before the lights go out, I can see the pale blue and white tiles glistening like Luca Della Robbia's.
That was Peter Balakian reading from his book of poetry, Ziggurat, on New Letters on the Air. I guess one reason I wanted you to read this part was the Duchamp reference, because there's a great deal of 20th century art mixed in with ancient history here, and I found it fascinating the way you made those connections.
The visual arts have preoccupied me as a writer forever. I mean, it's really a kind of node of imaginative engagement for me. So I think in terms of visual texts all the time, and I found in this poem many interesting opportunities to find works of art very alive and resonating with their various meanings. And the Duchamp vision of New York struck me as just brilliant.
I think it's brilliant to put it in the poem, because you get,
Thank you.
You get the sewage and you get the artwork and you get New York all bundled up with Sumeria. It's quite lovely.
Yeah. Duchamp did that, but I was happy to stumble on it.
that's what it's all about. It's
great.
stealing, at the right moment. Let's move on to part 25, shall we?
I might, for context, note that the poem, which is in 45 sections, weaves several strands of experience that are going through the persona's mind as he's traveling on the subway. And then he, meaning the narrator, flashes back to a time when he lived in Manhattan and a relationship he was in was breaking up. And then further remembers running mail around Lower Manhattan. And those three strands are then joined by a fourth strand in which the narrator's former student, who was in 2006 the ABC anchorman, is badly injured by the explosion of an IED as he's covering the war in Iraq.
Bob Woodruff?
I don't use his name in the book, but that is the real connection in my life to Bob and his wife Lee, who are both my former students. In this case, I treaded closer to a kind of documentary connection to the experience, hoping to use it with utmost care and detachment. So I changed their names as well. Anyway, that's the sort of shape of this poem, and I'm happy to read part 25, in which the remembered relationship is in the narrator's mind. I loved your love of myth and ritual. I loved reading Eliade with you on the train. The Ouroboric windows hugged the car. The spring rain washed away the serpent's tail. Just as our moment passed like Ash Wednesday, when you returned with the sign on your head, everything went black and silent, like that Saturday when Jesus lay in the tomb before the apotheosis we waited for all spring long. I loved how you took me down Pentecostal without restraint or faith into the dark vaults lower than the 4th Street station. No mythological bullshit here. You were the realest of the real, with your mad black hair and your crushing childhood. Your lips of plum and turpentine were signifier and signified. The crepe de chine, the lace, the chinoiserie, the strange clock your father brought from Thrace, kept ticking at us as if we were in Attica.
Even though this poem is 30 pages and 45 parts, it's not a laborious read at all. I mean, it just really pulls you in throughout.
Thank you.
And I do really love how you flash from scene to scene and place to place. It's sort of cinematic because you go from one image to another. Not in a jerky way, but in a way that you never get tired of any one locale. And I like the way you worked Christianity into this poem, too, and the way you work all the religions of the world into the book. Could you comment on that a little bit?
You know, here I feel the characters, the relationship being remembered, organically engaged, their religious traditions, the young man and the young woman had grown up with. And there's the Armenian Orthodox Christianity, and there's Catholicism, and that plays a little dance through the poem. And I think that the mythic dimensions of religious thought and tradition are potentially always very exciting when you can tap into them. So I was interested in finding moments that were rich and tap inable too. So if the poem unfurled some of that, I'm very happy, because religion supplies many things. That's one of them.
There's also a 70s political element. How does that tie in with the general theme of the poem, the World Trade Center and the connection between it and the ancient world?
My aspiration here, I guess, was to really trawl so much of the whole culture of the 70s, of the period, into the poem so that nothing could be left out or separated. You know, the Agnew impeachment and resignation. It opens with an image of Nixon waving goodbye on the chopper after his departure and resignation. And inflation, New York City in financial trouble, the famous headline that was in the Daily News back in 1975, President Ford to city, drop dead. I'm interested in all of those moments, the jazz and music scene and the art scene as it was defining cultural life in New York of that period. Very rich period, complicated, interesting period. Many see it as a very pivotal period in American history, because you know, many, many strange things, some of them very bad things, came out of the messes of the mid-70s. And by 1980, you have Reagan and the conservative revolution, perhaps, coming out of all that went wrong in the mid to late 70s. So I'm interested in the whole cultural fabric in its most comprehensive way.
This is New Letters on the Air, and our guest is Peter Balakian, whose book of poetry is called Ziggurat. You know, I think writing about art and music is one of the hardest things that a poet can do. And I think that it is rarely successfully done. And I think you get really big kudos for the way you've written about art in this book.
Thank you.
Why did you pick Warhol? Because there are several poems about Warhol in the book.
Well, I felt that he had done something very inventive in creating the silkscreen technique that he did in order to engage and explore historical moments that were happening before us. This book has several poems that meditate on Warhol silkscreens. And I found in the Warhol silkscreens a compelling way into bringing together art with history, which is what Warhol did in his own practice. And I found as a poet, there was an interesting dialectic going on. And so this poem, for example, takes off on the Warhol electric chair silkscreen of 1963, a silkscreen Warhol did to emblemize the last act of capital punishment in New York State, which took place at Sing Sing, prison up the river, just a bit up the Hudson River. This is called Warhol Electric Chair 63. A very red and green silkscreen. The red spreads like Christmas wrapping. The green, a field in a Caucasian rug. It's almost beautiful without the metal plates for the head, though the plug on the floor is visible. Before decorator colors and Hockney, Calvin Klein in the summery Hamptons, before there were switches to break the flow. My mother used to say, never touch a radio when you're in the bathtub. Never fly a kite near transmission lines. But still it's furniture. Still it's a typical American way to go. It's Sing Sing, the silhouette of Ethel Rosenberg. In the rheostatic air, the absent man heard, she loves you. The British invasion and the flat line arrived at once. Outside, Negroes were eaten by dogs. Johnson was sworn in. Cuba turned red in the Green Sea.
This last line is fabulous. Cuba turned red in the Green Sea. That's wonderfully done.
Thank you.
And I love the way you've tied Warhol's painting to your personal history and to American history.
I have another Warhol poem called Warhol Race Riot, 63.
You have a Jackie one.
And I have one about Jackie. And those historical moments he caught hold of in a kind of lyrical way, in a haunted way. And I got interested in them now from my own place, looking back into a time that I remembered and had grown up in. And his silkscreens, as I note, help entangle some dimension of aesthetic encoding with history. Mm-hmm. And for me as a poet, it's kind of a place where I live. So I found myself gravitating to what his silkscreens might offer as a catalyst.
You have small leitmotifs that I found kind of amusing. We're not going to read the Jackie poem, but you refer to Jackie's Valium-infused
face. Almond eyes glazed with Valium.
Yeah, glazed with Valium.
The numbed-out mouth.
And then,
you know, I'll tell you just as an interesting footnote. I was 12 years old at the Kennedy assassination and watching Jackie on the screen for the first time on TV after the assassination with my father, who was a physician. And he turned to my mother and said, I wonder what they have her on. So it was an interesting physician's response that as a kid, just, wow, I would have never thought of that. Mm-hmm. So that stayed with me all these years. So when I came to this moment in the poem, I made that connection in it because things your parents say at such moments stay with you.
You bring Valium back in when you're referring to Nixon. So that was, I guess, a small theme of that era. The Rolling Stones, you know, and Mother's Little Helper, I always think that's probably Valium. Okay, now part three of Ziggurat features two poems that were first published in New Letters magazine. So I'm thinking that your Emily Dickinson poem would be maybe the one to read.
This poem called Reading Dickinson, Summer 68, which I'm grateful to have had in New Letters, evolves from a moment in my life when I was a high school football player and discovering poetry and discovering Dickinson and the evocation of my summer job, which as a mail runner in lower Manhattan also involved working in the stockroom of this company. So those two things come into the poem. Reading Dickinson, Summer 68. In the hermetic, almost dark, under the fluorescent diz, I found her broken nerves, smoke coming off the dashes, the caps like jolts to the neck, the pried open spaces between vowels where the teeth bit off twine and the tongue was raw, then cool with ice. The air of the stockroom after lunch was the marbleized silence of the small blank pages she stitched into privacy. Air of paper and faint glue, bond, carbon, graph, yellow pads. In the stockroom I could read alone, and the confetti of money dissolved on the blank wall. After work I slid the numbered poems on blue Mimeo into my playbook and felt the open field, the zigzagging past cornerbacks, the white lines skewed to heaven. Excuse my mood, unbridled, chemical, her scrawled messages smooth to the mind. Excuse my absence again, and yes, then too, the cold stone of the Palisades was there after we split. Alone, naked, in the Hudson, the water greasing me in the tepid chemical mix before I returned to the cement of 9W and my father's skylark, the night black and soundless within.
Peter Balakian reading from Ziggurat on New Letters on the Air. The way that Dickinson poems hit your narrator in such a physical way and biting and, you know, that kind of the descriptions that you have of her language, it almost sounds to me like the way a lot of people would describe their reaction to Sylvia Plath.
Yeah, I think there are real connections there. And clearly, in some kinetic way, Plath is a daughter of Dickinson.
Yeah.
A Massachusetts daughter, albeit.
Yeah, you know. But I love the way you had such
Thanks.
A visceral response. I wanted you to read from Grant's Tomb.
Do you want me to say a few things about
the
occasion here?
Of course,
My interest in monuments in this book, I suppose, is obvious. And here's a monument that sticks out on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, with all of its weirdness and historical layers, the enormous mausoleum and tomb of Ulysses S. Grant, the great general for the Union Army during the Civil War, and then
not so good president
of the 1870s in the very troubled decade that followed Lincoln's assassination and the collapse of Reconstruction. Anyway, The two characters in this poem find themselves in 1970 taking some hallucinogenic drugs as they're roaming around the Upper West Side and find themselves stumbling into Grant's tomb. And so I'll read these sections. 5. As if the Civil War ended here, where Riverside Drive pushed to Harlem, and the black voices of the choir spilled into the river, where James Baldwin swept the pages from his father's pulpit into piles of trash that wound along the sides of the tomb. Take me to your leader, take me to your heart. The black spray paint floated in the dark on the marble columns. 6. We lived in Nixon's demonology between Joe Namath and Andy Warhol, the hard targets beneath the canopy, Cambodia was glowing phosphor. Our bodies were torqued like the stone eagles at the entrance to the tomb. We weren't afraid of pain or death or the granite of history. We knew better. We kept saying we knew. We had apprehension. We got airwaves from Radio Hanoi, heard violins, Buddhist chants, the sounds of cobras and F-45s, enemy movement. Cipolla was jungle juice, wires gone wrong.
Have you been working on these poems all along, or is this something you sort of went intensely into in the last couple of years?
I started working on this between 2003 and 2009.
Yeah. So not long after the World Trade Center.
Right.
What's the black hole?
Well, I'm playing with the idea in physics that there are black holes in the universe. And I'm reflecting on having studied some of the kind of eerie and apocalyptic things you learn about when you study what black holes are. So I take the black holes with me as I'm climbing up by elevator up to the 80th floor of the World Trade Towers and thinking about sound and space. World Trade Center, Black Hole 74. I may have flunked physics, but I was full of black holes and wind that was slamming the tower as I rose in the glass box up to the 80th with a check from Chilean Line. Black holes opened relativity, created frozen stars. In the sky lobby on the 99th, I loafed over the headlines of John Dean's testimony and the suicide of a CEO. I heard the relativity of the wind. Everything was like. I was trapped in similes I hated. I couldn't leave my head. And so the sound was insidious, then beautiful. Then it was there. If I say I once heard birdbone pipes in an old church in the Caucasus, like this wind blowing in the tracery of the top floors, in the pipelines and farther up. Through the glass I could see the other tower wavering, the silver like broken mica. I was falling matter dislodged by the idea of a place from which nothing can return. Jackie Wilson's tremolo, Paganini's broken wires, the frantic shaking of the small bells at the altar. Going up into some place beyond the smudged out sky, above the radar needle, above the planes coming out of the fog on their way to Newark. It was possible to hoist an object out of a black hole with a rope. This bit of knowledge I was hanging on to.
Peter Balakian's World Trade Center, Black Holes 74, from his 2010 book, Ziggurat. He was interviewed that year by Rebecca Preston Mosby at Colgate University in New York, recorded by Raynard Deli and Rich Grant. His next poetry book, Ozone Journal, won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize. Both collections contain poems first published in New Letters magazine. To subscribe, visit newletters.org. Today's show was originally produced with Annie Walsh and Dennis Conroe, with updates by Olivia Gallo and Jamie Walsh. To help us create new radio shows, call to join our Save New Letters on the Air team, 888-548-2477, or write to radio@newletters.org. That number again is 888-LIT-AIRS. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.